This is The Conversation. It's episode 217 with Courtney Childress. She is an artist based in Queens, New York. She is also former gallery director at On Stella Rays, and she now does some business for various galleries, things like setting up their databases, bookkeeping, etc. So she's been on both sides. I'm Michael Shaw. The website for this podcast is theconversationpod.com, where you can check out some awesome images of Courtney's great work, as well as her ongoing project. I don't know if it's side project, Mother of a Thousands, which is actually the name of a succulent plant. And she did an installation recently at Mrs. Gallery, former guest of the show. And she's also got an installation in her own apartment, as well as an ongoing sort of succulent studio in the hallway of her building in Queens. So check out all of those images on the website. We talked about all kinds of stuff, everything from gentrification in Ridgewood neighborhood of Queens, where she lives and works, to being on both sides of being a gallery director, as well as being an artist, and how she got found out as an artist by some of the artists that she was representing. And we also talk about Freeze Art Fair, which she was on the verge of attending just after our conversation she had over to Freeze. And by the way, on the back end, I have a couple of bits from the Weiss Link. One of them is about Freeze New York, compensating the dealers for the apparent heat wave that went down not only in New York, but particularly in the tent. So more on that. Also have a little bit on suggested topics for your next art panel discussion. So that's coming up on the back end. And what else can I tell you? I'd like to tell you actually that Courtney is brought to us by former guest Katrina Newman from episode 213, who also brought us Hilde Lynn Helfenstein, who was the guest from last episode, who a number of you responded with quite passion about. It's quite an impassioned response if you haven't heard that one yet. So I want to give a big thanks to Katrina for being such a great friend of the show. And her project, Rivet, the website is Rivet, R-I-V-E-T.es. So Rivet is a project of open calls and residencies and so on. And I know that there's going to be a lot more built into that as time goes on, but apparently it's live. It wasn't when Katrina and I spoke. So go check that out. And thanks to Katrina for these recommendations and more. There's another one I imagine coming up fairly soon. Thank you guys for being here, and look forward to telling you more about those couple of links from the Vice links on the back end. All right. Thank you guys for being here. Let's get to that conversation with Courtney Childress, and I will talk to you more on the back end. Okay. So, Courtney, I'm talking to you. You are in Ridgewood, Queens, the borough of Queens in the city of New York City. So I'm not going to maybe linger as much about where you are as I have in the past in terms of gentrification and so on, but it still, I think, might be I still think it could be a good starting place. First of all, is Ridgewood maybe not necessarily the next Williamsburg, but is it, I don't know, the next Greenpoint? You know, how much have you, people like you, artists like you, been moving there over, I don't know, the last 2, 3, 4 years, would you say?
I would say Greenpoint, it's definitely like the Greenpoint of 10 years ago. You know, we're on a funny train line that, you know, decides to act however it wants, when it wants. And there's so huge, it's a huge Polish population and Italian over here. So it's very neighborhoody, it's very safe. And that's what originally drew me to it, because well, one, I could afford it. I could afford to live by myself and have a studio in my apartment. And it was a really pleasant commute into the city, et cetera. So, I would say I've lived here for 4.5 years now, and definitely the neighborhood's changing, and more artists are moving to the neighborhood, and new bars are popping up all the time. It's definitely Greenpoint-ish.
Right.
And it's a nice, really nice community of artists that has moved in and have studios all over the place.
Yeah. So if you go back, like, I don't know, 15 years, let's just say, maybe, maybe even less than that, would Ridgewood be a kind of place where you would mention it to somebody, you know, one of your friends or colleagues, and they would go, what, where, where's that?
Yeah,
kind of thing?
Definitely.
Yeah.
Definitely. I mean, it's still the case when I say where I live to some people that are more Brooklyn or, well, more Manhattan focused. They're like,
right.
Where's Ridgewood?
Yeah.
And I'm like, well, you know where Bushwick is? It's close to Bushwick. And they're like, oh yeah, that's where all the artists live. And I'm like, yeah, exactly. So it's funny. I get that a lot.
Are we talking about a tale of two cities here where you and your artist colleagues, you know, live in the Bushwicks and the Ridgewoods of the world, and this sort of, let's say, abstract or sort of generalized Manhattanite is relatively oblivious to, you know, other than maybe Williamsburg, you know, the outer boroughs and what goes on there?
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely a city divided on a lot of different things, wealth, rivers. There's definitely big dividers in this. But, you know, I have to say, as New York is, it's sort of a ever-shifting plane.
Right.
Artists are moving out deep into Queens and Brooklyn, but they're also moving up into Harlem and way uptown and into the Bronx because it's where their space. So, you know, it's funny to have been here for a decade now and watched how the Lower East Side has shifted and how there used to be, you know, a handful of galleries in the Lower East Side, and now there's hundreds. And there's so many people moving to Chinatown, and, you know, that's a whole different thing. And getting collectors and curators and writers to your space when you're, you know, in these funny, funny little parts of the city. New York keeps us on our toes to sort of sum it up.
Yeah. Right. I actually just have one more sort of general observation that I wanted to make about, you know, that changing tide. Because I made that question about these sort of presumably wealthy Manhattanites who are like oblivious to, you know, the serfs, you know, out in the outer boroughs and whatnot. But, and you talked about the divides, income wise, divides, rivers wise, and so on.
Yeah.
I actually want to make a case for the fact that you and people like you are still in New York. You know, there's so many people who have left the area completely, not even the Hudson Valley. You know, they've gone to places like Los Angeles and, you know, and other places. So they've gotten
and
out of
Philly
it.
Philly and Pittsburgh
and
Detroit. And I know tons of people that have just jumped ship completely and for good, great reasons.
Yeah.
There's more space. It's cheaper. It's, you know, there's great artist communities there too, and people are making really dynamic, interesting work based on being not in New York, which I think is really amazing. Sorry, I didn't mean to.
That's a really good point. But at the same time, we should underscore why it still is beneficial to be in the New York area, if not in New York City, like you are, and that is the connectivity, the access to more shows than you will see anywhere else in the country. Why don't you take it from there? What comes to mind?
I mean, all the same reasons that I moved here in the first place are still true. Like, I wanted to be where all of my favorite institutions are, you know, like, on any given day, I can see some of the most monumental, important works of, you know, the last 70 years in this city, which is unbelievable. And aside from that, like, there's just this energy about this place and this sort of pace of the art world here that makes you hustle harder and want to make better work and keeps you energized in this way. And I've, for me, I need that. At least now I'm still on board with the hustle and the grind and the chaos of it all, because I have unbelievable cohorts and people around me that challenge me and excite me and that I feel supported by and can support.
Yeah. Yeah, that's exactly the kind of thing that's going to keep somebody in New York, right? I mean,
you don't get that. Sure.
You don't get that elsewhere. And yet, as you're saying that, I'm thinking, well, you don't live like in a. I don't know Ridgewood. I know Greenpoint. Mm-hmm. I know Williamsburg and so on. But you don't.
Yeah.
I presume you don't live maybe in as intense a neighborhood as other parts of the city. And also, you do have your own place. So between those two things, I imagine, and correct me if I'm wrong, that provides a certain respite maybe from the chaos at times.
Definitely. Yeah. Definitely. And that was another reason I moved out here. It was really important because I was, at the time that I moved into Queens, into Ridgewood, into this place, I was the director of a gallery in the Lower East Side. And so I was in the middle of the chaos and the intensity of the art world in this great way. But getting to leave there and get on the train for 40 minutes and show up in a place where there was trees and you could hear birds and like bugs at night, like the creaking bugs at night was huge. Mm-hmm. Like that balance is critical. You're totally right. It sort of provides some respite from the chaos of the city and the art world.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. You mentioned your gallery job. Why don't we start with where you are now, and then maybe we can start at the beginning. So are you still one of your day jobs now working at a gallery?
No, I've left the gallery world.
Oh, okay.
And that was after, you know, about 7 years of being a director at one place and, you know, consulting for other galleries. And then I started a space myself a couple of years ago with two dear friends. And I left that in September of last year, in 2017, to focus on my own work and to sort of also because I was rethinking the whole gallery system and how I could support other people, other artists within that system. And it was feeling like it wasn't a great place for me to be for a lot of different reasons, but mostly it was just time for me to be my own art champion instead of doing it for a lot of other people.
Yeah. So,
I
could ask you a ton about that and maybe I will, but
sure.
What, so does that mean that you're supporting yourself with your work?
No, definitely not, far from it. But I, like I said, I've been consulting for galleries and artists doing web work, and I help people with archives and databases and systems just all the sort of organizational parts of running a business as an artist or a gallery, and making sure that all your information is captured and sort of stored properly, because that's an incredibly important part of running a business, and most people don't know how to do that or how to do it well. So that's primarily what I've been doing to support myself.
Okay, and what does that look like? I mean, is that all done on site? Is that some on site, some at home? How often do you do it, and so on?
Usually it depends, because it's freelance. I will come in to a gallery and have a discussion with the people that brought me in, talk to them about what they need. Sometimes that means research, which I'll sit and do at home, and then present them with information based on their needs and what I know. And then usually that means also implementing some systems in-house. So I'll spend time in the gallery or in an artist studio or office, helping them get set up and training whoever it is that's going to be using the system to make sure that they feel comfortable running with it when I'm not there, that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And so I've been doing that. I'm also a bookkeeper, so I do bookkeeping for galleries and artists. I've specialized in the things that most artists say that they're really bad at.
Right.
And it means I can help a lot of people.
Yeah.
It's nice, and I do all right with that. You know, I'm able to support myself with those two ventures for the most part.
And how many hours in a given week would you say you devote to both of those things?
That depends. Some weeks I could have one bookkeeping job and nothing else. And so that means I try and take advantage of it and spend a lot of time in the studio or, you know, working on hustling for more work or whatever. Then other weeks it's like, you know, I work a 50-hour work week, you know, it just depends. It's very, you know, as the freelance, it's freelance life, you know?
Yeah, totally.
So, you know, it's boom or bust. You have to kind of learn how to balance that out.
Right, right. And yeah, and as you're saying that, I'm kind of thinking, you actually said a moment ago, if you have one week where you're just doing one bookkeeping thing, it's one of the other things that you're doing is you're kind of hustling to get more work. But I'm kind of thinking if you're working like a 50-hour week one week and maybe a 40-hour week the next, that you would just want to focus on your work and kind of take a break from the hustling.
I think because I'm still sort of establishing myself as a freelancer as opposed to having a normal 9-to-5 job, my MO is definitely to kind of always be hustling towards adding a new job to the mix. So I don't want to ever find myself without the next project to work on, because some of these, as I'm doing these things, sometimes I'll work on something and work a 50-hour work week and then that's it. Like that's all I'm doing for them. And then it's done. And it's not like I am guaranteed anything else from that job. Maybe a follow-up, you know, but for the most part, that's it. So it's, you know, there's always a hustle. Especially here. I feel like, you know, to be in New York and also hustling, I mean, you know, getting my own work out there and working on my own website and doing my own bookkeeping and all the things that go along with making my work as a business.
Yeah, that's good to get a better sense of that whole picture that you're hustling in many different ways. But that said, you know, you did originally say or imply that you were hustling to get more work. And it just made me wonder, and I know that's just one of other hustles, but how much of it is, I know that there's a certain amount of the work that you've been getting that's organic, you know, through your connections, through the prior jobs you've had, the people you've known through those jobs and so mm-hmm. on. But have you been at points where you're just like, I'm going to follow up on the correspondences I've had with these people, you know, from a few years mm-hmm. ago. I'm going to cold email some galleries and say, you know, hey, I just want to see if, you know, you need any assistance with your bookkeeping, that kind of thing.
You know, no, I mean, I'm much more of a in-person sort of, cold calling just doesn't seem to actually be that great of a way of getting anything done in the
sure.
art world,
right,
as far as I understand. You know, word of mouth and recommendations are definitely the way people share vendors that they like in the art world. And so, you know, I've been bookkeeping for Mrs. Gallery, and you talked to them not so long ago. And I just started doing that for Sarah because she's a dear friend, and she, you know, she's working so hard and doing so many amazing things. And I she was like, I know you know this side of things. Would you help me set up my bookkeeping? And I was like, yeah, of course. And so I went in and did it the first round, and I was like, okay, well, you know, this and this and this, and you want me to come back next week? And she was like, yes, please. And since then she's recommended me to a few people. And, you know, one of those has ended up being a regular client. So mm-hmm. it's just, for me, as I understand it, it's definitely, definitely best to just put yourself out there and let people know in person as you see them. And then,
right.
if you're good at what you do, you'll inevitably end up with good business.
Right. Right. And just to sort yeah. of put maybe a final point on bookkeeping, is bookkeeping in the way that you're doing it, setting up a QuickBooks, you know, file for that business. Mm-hmm. And then ultimately that ledger, that digital ledger, is going to be passed mm-hmm. on to an accountant finally at the end of the year
yeah.
or four times a year?
I'm not an accountant by any stretch.
Right.
But yeah, I do books too. I do books that then you can give, or you can, they're accountant ready, as they say.
Right. Got it. Okay.
Yeah.
Got it. So here's a really, for me, an important question or an important line of thinking about who you are and what you do. And that is, and you sort of alluded to it when you talked about how you moved on from first being a gallery director and then co-starting your own gallery to taking more care of yourself and your own work.
Mm-hmm.
And that is the state of being an artist who also works in galleries, you know. And I particularly want to underscore the challenge of being perceived as, you know, maybe being an artist second to whatever you're doing. Like if you're mm-hmm. co-directing a gallery, you're thought of as, oh, she started X gallery. Or mm-hmm. if you're the director of, was it On Stella Rays that you were the director of?
Yeah.
So she's the director of On Stella Rays. And maybe Courtney, the artist, comes up, but maybe she's just known that way. And I just want to know, I just love to hear, I should say, how that has evolved over the years and how you're thinking about that has evolved over the years.
Sure. You know, I think when I first started in the gallery world a few years ago, it was really not, I wouldn't say looked down upon, but it was sort of, it was a little taboo to be an artist to the dealer, as they said.
Mm-hmm.
And so in my work, I had two separate parts of self, the gallerist dealer where I did all the art fairs and was sitting at the front desk and was my artist's biggest champion. And then the person that would go home at the end of the day and spend, you know, a couple of hours in my studio making work and then really sort of showing in Brooklyn and not having those two things, I compartmentalized them completely, mm-hmm. you know? Mm-hmm. And for reasons that people sort of poo-pooed the idea that it was okay to be both. And more I'm finding that that's, people look at it as a great thing that you came from an art background and make work, and are a gallerist because you really kind of have a deeper understanding of what your artist's needs are and how they should be treated. And I have a deep understanding of materiality that somebody that just comes from an art history background or went through curatorial studies doesn't have.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think, you know, as the years went by and I slowly sort of let that wall between the two parts of myself drop, mostly because I got outed by my artists, they were like, they picked up on the fact that I was really sensitive to what they were doing. And they were like, you must make work. And then, you know, I shared what I did with them and they started becoming my champions, which was really wonderful and really made me understand that you can do both. And it's almost a great thing. What I said about leaving the gallery world and focusing my own art and work and being my own champion, you know, that's about half of the reason. That's a half of the reason mm-hmm. that I left. Mm-hmm. Having some dedicated time to me and my career and what I was doing with my work is half of it. The other half is definitely seeing the art world change in this way that I didn't really love. Mm-hmm. You know, there's a disposability with artists and it's not the thing I signed up for when I first started in the gallery world, which was I was lucky in that I worked for a woman that was really dedicated to working with somebody. Like, she didn't take these decisions working with artists lightly. So when she brought somebody on, it was a relationship that we would be in indefinitely, you know, really taking care of people. And it was familial and a deep connection. And we understood one another really well, and it was like, you know, we were in it for the long haul. And it's becoming more and more rare to find that world.
Right.
Somebody that does that with their artists. And so, and that's not to say that the new model is not something that can be cool and interesting too. It's just not the one that I signed up for, you know?
Yeah. One of the things that really stood out to me of what you just said is two things. One is that you described working at this gallery, and was it the on-sale arrays in which, you know, these artists that you were working with recognized you were an artist?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So the thing that really stood out to me or really occurred to me is that that's like a best case and wonderful, as you said, scenario, you know, that you're working for these artists and one or a couple of them are like, hey, I think, you know, I'm picking up on something here. And then long story short, mm-hmm. they turn around and champion you. And that's a beautiful thing. I mean, that's what you want. That's what you hope for. But as you're saying that, I'm thinking, wow, how many situations like that? For every situation like that, there've got to be 5 or 10 situations where an artist is working at a gallery and the artist that they're working for never asked them about them being an artist. And they, you know, and if they do, it never goes beyond the fact that they acknowledge that they're an artist. You know what I mean?
Yeah, totally. And I know that that's the case a lot.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then the other thing that occurred to me just as a general concept is you articulated how, what an asset as an artist you can be to a gallery because you have these material sensibilities and sensitivities, you know, and whatnot. So if you flip that around, how advantageous is it as an artist to have worked in galleries? And you are sort of living proof of that in to the extent that, you know bookkeeping and you know how to sort of organize business models and what have you, or archives, as I think you allude to. But apart from that, does it feel, you know what I mean? Does it feel like the artist who has worked for galleries, that experience is benefiting them to the same, in the same way or to the same degree, I should say?
I think it really can. Mm-hmm. You know, like you said, my experience in the working for a gallery, and mind you, I have to just point out that I worked for an amazing woman that was, I would say, like, she had great integrity and really, she had an MBA. And mm-hmm. so I learned how to run a business from somebody that actually studied business,
right.
Which was a huge, I mean, I think that was really special. You know, and not the case for most gallerists. I think most gallerists have a passion for art or a background in art history, and they might have a keen eye, and that'll get you part of the way. But understanding how to make a thing go is crucial.
So
I'm so lucky that I learned what I did from Candace at Onstella Rays. I would say I've tried really hard to sort of share that knowledge and understanding of how to run a business and be organized and careful with everybody that I'm close to. Cause you know, the things that we're taught in school, I think, you know, that's, I'm going to get on my soapbox for a second about the way artists are educated, and that, you know, even if you do take a professional practices class in grad school or undergrad, you know, they're not teaching you a lot of the really important parts about making work as a business. And you know, I say that and it's probably, some people are going to like make a face about it because they're like, oh, it shouldn't be so business-like or whatever. But you know, if you want to do it right and want to see your career have longevity, treating it like a business is important. But as far as working in a gallery being beneficial to my own time as a maker and an artist, it's been huge.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I had a thought, and it's going to come back to me. And that is, gallerists who are coming from a business background, as you described your former boss, that seems to me kind of more ideal in terms of, like, you can learn, let's put it as a question. Can you learn the nuances of contemporary art and, you know, whatever you need to represent and to best promote that work as well or better than if you are trained from the aesthetic, you know, or from the art historical side, and then you try to learn the business? You know what I mean? Is it easier going from business to running a gallery or being, you know, trained on the art side and then learning the business on the job?
Well, the way that Candace always explained it, when people would ask her about her MBA and why she didn't, because she didn't have an art history background or art history degree, or she didn't make work, so she didn't get a BFA, MSA. And she always said, you know, well, I have a passion for art.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. I can, that isn't going anywhere. You know, and the same is true for me. Like, I didn't study art history. I studied a lot of art history while getting my degrees, but I went to school to make work, and I'm a art history nerd and devour what I can as far as that's concerned. And then, like, having the business training is, I think, the harder part. It's not intuitive. It's, you know, you have to understand something that's not necessarily passionate or far easy.
Yeah.
That's the hard part. And so that's the part that she went to school for, because she was like, well, I don't know how to run a business, but I definitely love art. So, and that's not going anywhere,
yeah.
Which I was like, oh, exactly. That's it. And so I was lucky. I didn't go get an MBA, and I just got to learn from, somebody that did.
That's great. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well,
that's pretty great.
I would really be curious to hear some of your thoughts without making this too much of a, being an artist business person 101 kind of thing, but maybe on a more conversational level, like, what are some basic thoughts you have about putting your work out there? I mean, not necessarily like, you know, I mean, maybe this will come in the process, but I don't necessarily mean, you know, in terms of the building a digital platform, a digital business platform, a digital image platform, you know, basic things like that, that maybe are underdone in a lot of artist cases. More about building your presence and your brand, if you don't mind that term or what have you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, there's a lot of different ways to go about that. Some people are all over social media and they make that their platform to show up work and get followers. And if you can do it that way and you want to do it that way, more power to you. I try and be as genuine as possible with this stuff. And I go see shows that I want to see. I surround myself with people that I love and think their work is great and they're doing something important. And we have amazing conversations about art and go see shows together. And all of my opportunities have come from my community, not from me trying to put myself out there to gallerists or, applying to open call. I mean, okay, I've applied to a couple of open calls and gotten into things, and that was awesome. And for that, it got my work out to a handful of people that I now consider good friends. And it's just like, it's just about making work that's real and honest and is something that comes from a genuine place, and then having real relationships with people.
Yeah.
And that's it. That's really, you know, find galleries that you like and go to their shows and talk, say hello to people, you know, like go and talk and like be nice and friendly. that, you know, there's like, I'm Southern, and I don't know, I can talk to a brick wall, so I'll go to things and just like talk to whoever.
Right.
And that's gotten me really far, because I've ended up in great conversations with random people that I just like chatted with, and that have later become friends, or, you know, they're writers that I didn't even know was a writer, and that sort of thing. And I would say just being a real human being is the best way to get ahead in this art world, aside from just making good work.
Yeah. So you're Southern. I didn't know that.
Oh yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Where
Dallas,
Dallas
and Alabama.
Oh, wow. Okay. So yeah. Did you ever have an accent?
I still do some, I still do if I'm on the phone with my mom or talking to my friend Kelly, who's from Louisiana, and she has a pretty significant, she has a wonderful accent.
Right.
So I'll get going with her and it comes out. But for the most part, it kind of drops. I never had a big accent, but it definitely comes back a little bit when I'm around family or my Southern friends.
Right. But you could you put it on if you wanted to ever, or have you ever done that?
You know, I've in my brain, as I got pulled over once, and in my brain I was like, well, maybe if I put on a Southern accent, I can get out of this ticket. But then I was too much of a chicken to do it. You know, I don't really ever use it unless I'm, you know, I'm just playing around or being silly, or, like I said, talking to my family, it comes out. At that point, I'm not turning it on. It just comes out.
Right. Well, how do you perceive the accent? You know, now that you have some distance from it and years from it, I mean, do you ever hear people and go ahead?
Well, I would say there's definitely a stigma. Definitely a stigma in the Northeast towards Southern folks, I think. And I feel like when I first moved here and people were like, oh, you know, they could tell I wasn't from here, and they were like, oh, you know, where are you from? And I said, okay, well, I just moved here from Alabama. And like, their face would just sort of like, you could read that they were like, oh God. and you know, I know a million amazing people from the Deep South that are like full and open and not conservative and terrible and insane. And I don't know. I think people like to stereotype. It makes it easier for them to go about their lives.
Right,
But I love a Southern accent. I get on the phone with like my grandmother, and it just makes me so happy. People think Southerners are dumb because we talk slow or have a drawl or whatever. But it's just because it's real hot, so we're trying to save our energy. I think that's what I've decided why Southerners talk slow.
That's awesome. Yeah. That's great.
Yeah. So
one thing that stood out to me from what you were saying earlier about, I mean, I think it was great. I really appreciate the way that you described having a community and that your successes or your opportunities, I should say, have come through that community, through your friends, not from you going out and, you know, cold calling people or what have you. And I also like the way you described how, be nice, smile, talk to people. And you also described, you couched it, your social ability partially as being a Southern thing, but obviously it's more of an extrovert thing, I think, which I don't think that hurt. That doesn't hurt.
But it definitely doesn't hurt.
Yeah.
I'm very friendly, and I'm lucky in that. I know lots of artists are not, and it makes it more difficult for them.
Exactly.
But the nice thing about the art world is we are all the awkward weirdos. Everybody, that's the thing. every time I talk to like a young group of students and they're like, but I always feel so weird when I go to openings. And I'm like, look around you. These are the people that were in your art class in high school that were like goth and like jet black hair and too much like black eye makeup. They were the weirdos too. So you feel just, it's like you feel just as awkward as they are. And they might know more people here, so they feel a little more comfortable, but they're not going to, like, you know, poo-poo you. They're you, you know? It's the same thing. You're the same thing.
Yeah, I can see that you have that experience and you can see those types. I haven't seen that as much as I would like. I feel like there are far too many. I see far too many people who seem to be good players. You know what I mean? Mm. Whenever I see find out that people are sort of these alpha types or what have you, these jock sort of archetypes, if you will. It's frustrating because it's like, you know, what are you doing in this community? You know, it should be like 95%, you know, of the type of people you describe. So that's frustrating. It's not so, you know, one or the other. It's just that I think if you do go to certain openings, you're going to see more of the player types than you are, you know, and in fact, if you go to, maybe you can verify this as well. If you go to big time gallery openings, a lot of the people there are just kind of social hangers-ons, right?
Yeah, of course.
Yeah.
I mean, of course. But if you're going to, if you're trying to get involved, if you're trying to engage in the art community, going to those big giant monster openings are not where you're going to start building a community.
Of course not. Yeah.
You know, so they're kind of pointless. I don't go to the big Chelsea openings anymore. Like,
right.
I maybe did the first like year I was here, and then I realized, oh, well, I can't even see the work. This is a museum show. I want to come back when there's like me and the security guard, and that's it.
Yeah.
And so going to those kinds of openings, yeah, you're going to see big crazy players and, you know, the gamut of people like trying to suck up to those folks and do their thing. But that's not the kind of community that, I mean, I would hope that's not the kind of community that, that like your artists are trying to break into.
Sure.
You know, I'm talking more about like going to an opening in Chinatown and, you know, yeah, sure. There's plenty of people posturing and being cool, but deep down they're all, you know, they're weird and quirky and funny and maybe just as shy as somebody, you know, trying to get involved in the first place.
Sure.
So that's more what I'm talking about, about the, like, going to a big art fair, going to, you know, an opening in Chelsea, what have you.
Yeah, and I want to ask you, because you're going to freeze shortly after we speak, and we can maybe we can talk about that. But before we do, I just wanted to go back also to you talked about some people in terms of building your own, you know, your brand or your work, going using the social media route. And the thought that was occurring to me at the time was, I would say there are two types of artists that have big followings on social media. I'm thinking particularly Instagram. One is the type that makes work that is really graphic and accessible and is more, you know, more likely to have a bigger following. And the other are just artists who are really big names who already have a big following and they have an even bigger following on social media.
Mm-hmm.
Any thoughts?
Go ahead.
No, that was it. That was it. I just wanted to share that thought. Did you have anything you wanted to add to that?
No, I think you're right. I mean, that's true. The people that are already big names, of course, they have lots of people following them and paying attention to what they do. And then, yeah, there's definitely work that translates easier to a social media platform and to websites and digital everything. You know, and I actually spend a lot of time talking to friends that make sculpture and make installation and make work like that. And I'm always brainstorming a little bit with those guys about how to better have people, not just in social media land, but when they apply to residencies, et cetera, like understand the work better. And it's tricky unless you're making something that's flat and graphic and easy to read on a tiny screen. You're kind of out of luck. So it's like, that's a big challenge, I think, for people working in media. It's just a little, weirder.
You know, well, as you're saying that, I'm looking actually at your website, and I was looking at it earlier before we got on, and your works, I think, is a really interesting case in this regard, because it clearly does fall into the category of not super graphic, you know, and not necessarily easily translatable, but you photographed it so well that I feel like a lot of these could work quite well on Instagram, for example. You know, I mean, maybe
that,
just
that's a yeah. That's a big lesson learned. And I was lucky that my the head of painting at my BFA, when I got my BFA at the University of Alabama, was such a stickler about documentation that I learned well how to photograph my work. You know, the right lighting with the right camera, and you know, if you don't have it, borrow it. Because somebody around you does, that sort of thing. And if you don't know how to do it, ask one of your photographer friends to help you. And if you can't do it and you can pay for it.
Right.
You know, but documentation is critical, especially, because like I was saying, it's not, some work is not easy to read. And if you're applying to residencies or putting stuff up on a website, you've got to make it so it's legible, you know?
So you have, it looks like you have this sort of tangential business that is also your art, this mother of 1000s. These sort of customized cacti that you work with?
That's my other side business.
Right.
I've got a lot. You know, I'm a New York freelancer. I do a lot of stuff. I actually, my apartment, I think last count, I have 87 plants in my apartment.
Wow.
And so I amassed this collection of things that people were getting rid of when they moved, or, you know, clippings from my friend's parents' yard in Florida. I go to my friend's place in LA and pillage their yard. So all of this came from all over the place. And somebody asked me not so long ago to help them with making some arrangements. And so I did. And then that just sort of snowballed a little bit. And I just did an installation in the window of Mrs. for their current show of plants, which is fun. I got a mention in the New York Times this week for that.
Mazel tov.
Thanks. It was pretty exciting. I'm thinking about plants and art and how all those things intersect, because they definitely do in my world. But
What does mother of 1000s mean?
Well, mother of 1000s is a plant. It's this funny plant that I think it's native to South Africa originally, and then you can find them like in Florida. And I took one out of my ex-boyfriend's mother's yard, and it's this crazy plant. It looks like Jurassic Park, and it makes a million babies on the end of each leaf, and then those little babies drop off and fall to the dirt below and root and grow. And so it's this one big plant that keeps producing plants underneath it. And so it's literally a mother of thousands. Right. There's also a mother of millions.
Wow.
That's another.
Are they cactus though, or are they just plants?
No, I think it's a succulent. I think it's actually technically a succulent.
Right. Got it. And how is your business doing? How well do you sell these things?
Pretty well. This is relatively new, so I was just really making them for myself, and then other people, friends of mine, would come over and see, and they'd want one for themselves. And then I just did a friend's office. They just moved into a brand new office. A friend works for IFC, and he was like, come do my, will you do a bunch of arrangements for my new office? And so I did, and that's led to more. And I'm about to do a series of prairie grass arrangements for the stage of Lincoln Center for a benefit in June.
Wow.
So right now I'm learning about prairie grasses and going to grow some, which is a funny thing to think about doing in my backyard in Queens.
Sounds like a sweet side gig you got going.
Yeah, it's pretty fun. I mean, if I had my way, I would do this full time. I love plants are definitely my favorite thing.
That's awesome. So does this go back before your art school days, even working with plants, or did it develop sort of?
No, you know, this kind of developed in conjunction with art school days. A friend of mine, when I was getting my BFA at Alabama, was moving to Australia, and she gave me a money tree, and it was the saddest little piddly thing on the planet. And I took it in, and I put it in my kitchen window, and I prayed that I wouldn't kill it, because I never really kept plants alive before that, but I felt obligated because somebody gave this to me. Mm-hmm. And then I still have it. It's huge.
Wow.
Now it's like, it was like a 6-inch tall plant. I mean, that was like, oh God, how long ago was that? Maybe 15 years ago, something like that. And now it's like probably 3.5 feet tall, 4 feet tall, something like that.
Wow.
It's a pretty significant little tree now. And yeah, it spiraled from there. I just, I started going into friends' apartments and saying, well, what's that plant? Can I have a piece of that? And, friends would give me clippings from their plants, and, the collection was started. And now I have plants from all over the world, and, really cool, rare, funny, monstrous things that look like they shouldn't exist but do.
Right.
Pretty neat. Yeah.
But your thing with your mother of thousands is to take, not only to sort of cultivate the plant, but also to sculpturize it or contextualize it into a certain type of receptacle with rocks or whatever, right? Right.
Yeah. Okay. And then, you know, also, you know, my work from a few years ago, I still use sort of domestic objects and things that you'd find around the home, in my work. And that I just sort of brought the plant. I sort of connected the plants with those funny sound objects and these assemblage things. And you know, they're funny and sort of like they're silly and good and maybe not the first thing that you would notice, but definitely like would catch your eye, maybe out of your periphery if it was in somebody's home or in an art gallery.
Right.
Yeah. So yeah, the plants are definitely creeping into my practice. Pun completely intended there.
I'm still going to beep it.
Okay.
So, you actually, that's a good segue, because I one thing I want, before we talk about Freeze, I wanted to ask you about working at home. having your studio in your apartment, which is something that I did in New York back in the day, probably in a much smaller apartment than what you're in now. But I know, let's talk about the pros and cons real quickly. The pros obviously are convenience, accessibility. As you said, when we spoke last time, you can wake up, waddle out of bed and, you know, into your workplace. But the cons, as I see it, are if you have studio visits, you know, it could potentially be a little awkward. Maybe you have it set up so that it feels like a studio. You have the fact that you're always around it. You don't get much perspective, maybe. I know that's maybe a little forced of an argument, but I could see how it could be beneficial in that, like, it sort of seeps into your consciousness more, you know, and you can sort of work out some of the issues in your head. But at the same time, I can feel like, oh, I'm like, I'm just in the thick of it. And I know that there's some artists who are probably like, yeah, I want to be in the thick of it all the time. But for to play devil's advocate, that feels a little oppressive too.
Yeah, for sure. You know, I've had things both ways in my time in New York. I've had the benefit of having a beautiful studio where I could put all of that stuff and step away from it, work all day, step away from it, and then go work my 9-to-5 job. But it's increasingly difficult to find space that's close enough to where I live that it would make it worthwhile for me to have a space outside of my apartment. Because, you know, you have to, if you're talking about travel, like, you have to add travel time to all of this. And then if you're working a normal job, you leave that job and then you, you know, ride the subway for 45 minutes to an hour to get to your studio. And then you might work for 2 or 3 hours and then, you know, it's 9 o'clock at night and you have to get up and do it again the next day. And for me, that just didn't work. It was too expensive. I felt like I was burning my time sitting on the train instead of being actually in my studio working. And so, you know, some days it drives me crazy that my studio is in my apartment because I can't close the door and step away from it. I live in a railroad apartment, so I walk through my studio every single time I walk to my bedroom. and from my kitchen to my bedroom, I walk through my studio. But that also means my work is always kind of in my periphery. And when I don't have as much time to sort of be centered and focused on what I'm doing, that's a welcome thing, because then I can always sort of be thinking about it. Like, even if it's not my fourth, like, front thought, it's there, you know? And that's been a great way of working for me. Cause you know, after we jump off this call, I might go in my studio and tweak something for a minute and then run out the door and go to freeze, you know, and be gone the rest of the evening. And that works for me. It doesn't work for everybody, but I think as artists, we're pretty adaptable and you have to just figure out how to make whatever you can work, you know? Even if that means like you have a kitchen table, you know, make drawings.
That's a studio. The kitchen table studio. Totally. And, and how many, I think you may make a great case for your situation. How many of your, of that community, you know, your supportive community that you described, earlier, would you say also have in-home studios?
Quite a few, quite a few. You know, I would say, two of my really good friends have studios in their homes or apartments. You know, one's a mom and her studio's in the basement and, you know, that works for her because her kid can be like hanging out and playing and doing her own thing and Ryan can work. you know, my friend Kelly has a similar situation with her painting. She can paint in her spare room.
Mm-hmm.
And it's awesome.
Right.
So I think, you know, there's a lot of people doing it because it's affordable and works for them.
Sure. Right.
You know, I'm lucky in that I've got a studio. I've got my normal art studio in my apartment, and then I've got a plant studio set up on sort of the stairway of the second floor of my building in the hallway. And my neighbors love it because they get to be surrounded by a bunch of plants. And then one of my neighbors has a wood shop. He set up a wood shop and like a workspace in our basement. So, you know, if I need to cut stretchers or cut a table and, you know, like whatever I'm doing at the moment, I can run it downstairs and, you know, he's got a table saw. So
right,
that's a pretty sweet, I've got an ideal situation as far as studios go, I think.
Yeah. That's great.
Yeah.
So as you said, as we both acknowledged, you're going to Freeze. That is the New York version of the Freeze Art Fair. It's still on Randall's Island, I take it, right?
Yep.
And today's Thursday. So that means isn't this like the first day? Is it the preview day or whatever? What do they call it? The professional day?
The vernissage.
Okay.
So the vernissage, the like super fancy private preview special VIP was yesterday.
Right.
And this day is also a VIP day, but it's like the less important. Very important people.
The LVIP? LVIP.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. So, and, you know, I'm going to go and see friends and see some art. And, mm-hmm. you know, it's a beautiful day in New York. It's like 85 degrees. And what better way of spending the afternoon than riding a boat out to an island go in a tent and look at art.
Right. Oh, can you take a boat from Queens to the island, or do you have to come into the city and then take the tram?
No, I'll go to Manhattan and hop on the ferry at 34th Street.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
What about the tram though that goes across? Is that just a more fancy way of
getting there? Tram? No, I don't think that's more fancy. I think you can take that too. Just with your VIP pass, they give you like you get to get on the ferry for free.
Oh, okay.
Which is nice.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you know, it's just I feel like Freeze is fine. It's a fair art fair. As art fairs are art fairs, but I think the most fun part of Freeze is actually getting there and getting out there.
Mm-hmm.
That's more entertaining than the actual
right
being there and being in it.
Yeah,
in my opinion. There's tons of great art, and I do enjoy it. But it's like, yeah, the fun of it is riding the boat.
That's great. Yeah, I think you definitely got me on your side in that regard. I've been a pretty outspoken, not super outspoken, but I've definitely clarified that I'm not a big goer of art fairs, and I don't think that will ever change.
Sure.
But I think being the person you are with the background that you, the back story, you know, with your gallery work and so on that you have, you know, it makes sense.
Yeah. And, you know, art fairs really aren't for everyone. And I actually discourage a lot of artists from going to art fairs because I think it can really mess people up. Mm-hmm. I think it can really skew your idea of what you should and shouldn't be making. And I think if you're at all sensitive, if you're a sensitive person or susceptible to, you know, outside influence, it's not a great place to be. Art fairs should be for collectors and for curators and people that are consuming art in this other way. You know, most artists, I think their day would be better spent going to see the show at the Guggenheim right now. You know,
Is the Don Vo show still up?
And that's an incredible show. Like that's a much better way to spend a few hours of your day go to the Met, you know?
Right. If you're going to look at art. Yeah.
If you're going to go see art, like that's going to freeze. I mean, I have colleagues there and you know, I can sort of let these things wash over me because I've trained myself to let art fairs wash over me and not eat my soul. But you know, then at some point I'll find myself like there and not looking at anything and just staring at people's shoes because it's weird, because people's footwear is entertaining at art fairs. And then I know it's time to leave or have a sandwich, you know, like,
I need you to be my liaison, my chaperone for whenever I next do an art fair. I would love to have you as my chaperone because you got to figure it out. I've only been to a few, but if I had that insight, boy, it would be much more pleasurable experience.
I think so. It's like, okay, make sure you have the right kind of snacks. And wear comfortable shoes. And, you know, if you drink, you should maybe carry a mini bottle of something in your bag because you might need that fortification at some point. You know, you've got to just make sure your needs are met at an art fair because it's like going to the mall.
One last question about Freeze. Are there, I know you're going to have colleagues there. Is there going to be work shown of friends of yours as well?
You know, I'm sure. I'm sure. I don't know off the top of my head, but I walk around, I bet I recognize some buddies. You know, but probably not my neighbors in Ridgewood. Unfortunately, they're not the people that are getting shown at Freeze, but I definitely will know people that have work on the wall.
Right. Got it.
Yeah.
Well, enjoy, despite being only a L, or what did I say? Yeah. L VIP. You're still a VIP. You're still a VIP in my book. So enjoy.
I appreciate it.
Thank you, Courtney.
Be a guide, liaison, in whatever capacity I can be for the next fair you encounter.
All right. Let's pencil that in and I'll keep you posted. Thanks so much. Great talking to you.
Yeah, no problem. Okay. Bye.
Thanks so much again to Courtney for talking to me. I enjoyed that and hope you guys did. I did not directly follow up with Courtney about how Freeze was. I wonder if there's a little sheepishness around how hot it ended up being. Because in retrospect, when she said it's 85 degrees and beautiful, I thought 85 in New York, is that necessarily beautiful? It's getting pretty close to being uncomfortably warm. So anyway, I'm going to get to a relevant piece of information reported about Freeze New York and how they are planning on compensating some of their dealers in relation to that heat in a second, as well as another fun WeisLink related tidbit about art panels or panel discussions. First, I want to remind you that this is a listener-supported show. Big thanks to those of you who came on board, probably very much in relation to the Hilde Lynn Helfenstein episode from last episode. And there is a bonus episode attached to that. So for those of you who have not supported the show yet and want to come on board so you can listen to that as well as the four other bonus episodes, now is a fantastic time to do so. You can go to theconversationpod.com/support and you can donate to the show either via PayPal, one-time donation of $25 or more. And feel free to go higher than that, by the way. You don't have to just do the bare minimum. Or $5 a month pledge via Patreon. Those are both linked through the website. There's also PayPal Me, by the way. And I wonder if I'm thinking I should probably implement that into the site because I think it gets rid of the fees that come with your normal donation. So let me see if I can get that together. In any case, those are a couple ways you can donate. And again, for those rates or more, you can get the bonus episode, including Hildy Lynn Helfenstein, as well as the past four bonus episodes, Max Maslansky, Matt Gleason, Eric Yonker, and Dan Fox, most recently before Hildy. Sorry, no more women. We'll get more women in bonus episodes soon, I promise. And, of course, you can follow the show on social media, at Artist Podcast, on Instagram and Twitter, and become a fan on Facebook. You can, ideally, be very much appreciated if you leave a great review on Apple Podcasts so more people will find the show. And you can, of course, spread the word. Thank you very much for doing so. I appreciate your support. I appreciate your listening and being fans in the best of cases. Also, just wanted to take a quick second to thank many folks who are helping on the show and have been helping on the show, including, of course, Kate Mitchell, Sarah Bentley, Divya Jihodi, who helps with Instagram, and most recently, Andy Davis, who came on to help with producing the show along with the others. Thank you very much for coming on board, Andy, and to, of course, the rest of you for helping all this time. Really appreciate it. So let's get to just a couple of Weiss links from, by the way, Jeff Weiss, who is a former guest of the show. Every night puts out a list of anywhere from 1 to 15 different art news tidbits in an email blast that he sends to his list. I think it's closed because he can only have so many people on it at once, and that's why I'm sharing samples of them with you. You can certainly look into it. But anyway, that's just an FYI to give you a little context for this. So the first one, about Freeze, which we just talked about. And the heading is, Freeze New York to compensate all dealers after sweltering fair sent collectors packing. Freeze Art Fair will offer, quote, some compensation, unquote, to all galleries that were forced to exhibit in sweltering conditions as a heat wave swept New York last week, according to a spokesman for the fair. Quote, the details have yet to be finalized, but the commitment has been made, unquote, he said. A commitment has also been made to look at how to deal with increasingly erratic weather moving forward. Freeze New York has been dogged by bad weather. Last year, the fair was temporarily shut down due to flooding. During the two VIP days last week, dealers reported working in sauna-like conditions inside a newly configured tent with little air conditioning, which is said to have deterred collectors. And that's thanks to the Art Newspaper. Thank you, Art Newspaper. And finally, I will close with a lovely list of suggested topics for your next art panel discussion. This comes from Glass Tire, which I believe is based in Houston, by the way. Correct me if I'm wrong. So thank you, Houston, for your contribution to the show. Again, suggested topics for your next art panel discussion. This is the way they lead into it. Looking for programming to sex up your next art fair or fundraiser? Try these on for size. Flailing and hand-wringing 101, next steps for museums. Defining the 21st century museum, box with things in it or flashing human moth attractor? Faking interest in artists who aren't dead, a guide for museum trustees. Risk mitigation strategies for collecting artists of color, the five names museums should buy. We all hate art fairs, so why don't they stop? A Freeze talk. Fending off repatriation lawsuits, how to keep the art your ancestors stole. A wealth of choices, real estate options for dead galleries. How many zeros? Putting yourself on the map through art prizes. Curating curators, it's time. Conceptual art today, you're no Duchamp. And two great artist ones to close out the list. Artists, house cleaning and babysitting as social practice. Holy shit, I just beat myself, folks. I just beat myself. And finally, artists, how to spot the next shitty neighborhood to destroy through your willful gentrification. Which takes us back to the top of this show. Nezpa, thank you guys very much for being here. I hope you enjoyed all of that. Do let us know what you think. Thanks for listening, and I will talk to you in a couple of weeks. Until then, as you know, ciao for now, baby.